Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's webinar. My name is Myla Craig, and I'm the founder, president, and CEO of Milani, a Canadian-based advisory firm with over 15 years of history serving investors and issuers in building sustainability, responsible investing, and sustainable finance strategies. And I'll be your moderator today for this engaging conversation. We are here today to dive into a timely and important discussion on two key topics. One is the role of the financial sector in an energy transition. And the second is the phenomena of anti-ESG sentiment or ESG pushback, or what our guest calls the US culture wars, and the polarization that has become increasingly prevalent as a result. Before I begin, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the land on which we are gathered today. Although this event is virtual, I am situated on physical grounds and on the unceded traditional territories of Indigenous peoples in Canada. I am speaking from Montreal, located on lands that have never been formally ceded and were traditionally home to the Anishinaabe, the Wendat, and Abenaki nations. Montreal has historically been a hub for Indigenous diplomacy and cultural exchange. Its strategic importance draws on the area's first settlers. Today, the Mohawk Nation, particularly the communities of Ganawagi and Ganasitaki, adjacent to Montreal, continues to steward these lands and waters. Thank you for joining us today. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome our guest for today, Robert or Bob Eccles, who doesn't need or needs very little introduction. Bob is renowned as a thought leader in the move towards integrated reporting, academic and market research. He is currently a visiting professor of management practice at SAID Business School at the University of Oxford, chair of KKR's Sustainability Expert Advisory Council, and a senior advisor at the Boston Consulting Group. He is the founding chair of the US-led Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, or SASB, and one of the founders of the International Integrated Reporting Council, now part of the International Sustainability Standards Board, the ISSB. He has authored numerous influential books and articles on integrated reporting and sustainability. And we are very honored to have him with us today to share his insights. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Molly. Good to see you. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Our discussion today is going to unfold over the next hour, including a Q&A session. And I have many questions that for Bob, as I often do, as we get this opportunity to speak, but we also want to allow you, our audience, to ask your questions and have the opportunity to get responses directly from Bob as well. As such, Bob and I are going to speak for a few minutes, and then I'll be looking to see what questions you have. So your questions will be anonymous. So we encourage you to actively participate by submitting your questions throughout the webinar. Please type your questions in the Q&A box and as they come to mind, and I will try to integrate those in through our conversation. So with that, Bob, maybe we could get started. You and I've known each other for, I'm going to guess, over 10 years now.
Wow.
I know, eh? You were the chair of SASB at the time. Oh, wow. And I helped you make some connections to some of these Canadian pension plans who became highly engaged with SASB.
The Maple 8, the famous Maple 8 and others,
the
right?
The Maple 8, which is now I think the Maple 11, maybe something like that.
See, it's growing.
A few years later, you came back and you and I walked across the country and did a bunch of meetings around the statement of purpose. And we had a number of those conversations, which ironically, seems to be happening now. It took us a while for the Canadians to get on board on that. And I'm happy to have a conversation today about that if there's an interest. But, you know, let's fast forward. SASB now is part of the International Sustainability Standards Board. And then earlier this year, I got an email from Bob on a Sunday morning, I think, and suggested that he's got some new questions. And a question that's on your mind, Bob, seems to be about the financial sector's role in you know, pushing this energy transition. And this is part of why we're here today. I really want to understand what that means.
Sure.
So when we look at this ecosystem, you know, I know for myself, the financial sector has been one of the key pressure points as we think about integrating ESG and advancing the acceptance of climate as a systemic risk. But you're posing a new question is, you know, is that theory of change really accurate? You wrote an article back in April about untangling the financial risk and the climate risk and this climate impact. What's the difference? Can you describe to me what's asking you to pose this question, and what are these differences between financial climate and climate impact?
So let me give you a little bit of context, and then we'll get into the specifics around that article. So and we'll talk about the ESG culture wars more later, but you know, they've been going on, you know, pretty avidly for a couple of years, and I've been writing about it. And at the same time, I've had my GOP outreach campaign, and you've met some of my Republican friends like Dan Crowley and Tim Doyle. And so what we're working on is, you know, where do you find some bipartisan space where you've got sort of the extremes on the left and the right? But there's a place where people can meet that have different political persuasions. I sit here in Massachusetts. I'm a liberal, but I don't think all Republicans are evil people. I'm not a big fan of the MAGA crowd and Trump and all that. And they kind of are dominating the party right now, which I think is a tragedy. But that doesn't mean you can't try to move forward. As a subset of that, I started meeting a number of conservatives, investors, board members, think tanks, NGOs, who are basically focused on climate change, dedicating their lives to dealing with climate change. And I wrote a piece on New Year's Eve of last year called What I've Learned from Conservatives Addressing the Challenge of Climate Change. And this is where it first started to kind of come together for me, because what I found interesting was a lot of the things that are discussed in the world that I'm most familiar with, financial services, you know, liberals who really, you know, got the memo first, you know, credit all that. There wasn't a lot of talk about climate transition plans. There wasn't a lot of talk about, you know, GFANs and Climate Action 100, and we need scope 3 reporting. And it wasn't like, I mean, some of them were pretty cynical about it. Some of them were like, you know, kind of whatever. The discussions were much more about permitting. How do we get permitting? You know, I think it was more practical about how long fossil fuels will be around and for how much there will be. More enthusiasm for technologies. They didn't immediately discount, you know, carbon capture and storage the way many people do and say it's just a mechanism to enable the fossil fuel industry to persist forever. And I found it interesting and insightful, and I learned some things. And then I was, I don't know, 6 weeks ago at a private event hosted by a major financial institution. It was companies, it was investors, and everybody kind of said, we've got to get to net zero by 2050. Okay, just no question about it. Again, it wasn't climate change deniers. There was maybe $4 or $5 trillion represented in the room when I added it up. And people from companies, some of the stuff was, it could have been science fiction, but maybe it's not, like geothermal, right? It was geothermal, it was carbon capture and storage, it was hydrogen. Okay. And there was much more. It's a big challenge. It's serious, but we can do it. And we need the capital. We need to put capital to it. And there's the venture capital and there's the established business models. But there's that middle space where you don't need 10 million or 50, but you don't need 10 billion. You need a billion. So all of this is kind of coming together for me. And I'm thinking, well, here's a group of people that are investing real money, you know, in companies being led by very competent people, including one that is in Canada, I shall say, Claude Letourneau at Savanti, which I just published an interview with, which I'll send to you, but I was too busy preparing for our webinar. And I started really reflecting on this. And when you look at this narrative that's emerged on the left, which is the public sector is failing, the private sector needs to pick it up and do more. Companies need to do more, you know, asset managers need to do more. Asset owners need to do more. And I'm thinking, well, there's some truth in that. You know, don't want to be making the world a worse place, but how much can you do to make the world a better place? And can you really lead the energy transition with the financial sector saying we've got all of these assets and we're going to start making decisions, or we're going to be put ourselves under pressure by having net zero transition plans, which I think very few know how they're going to achieve them. Be sort of allocating capital in a way that's going to put pressure on companies to change. And even if they're not sort of doing divestment, they say we're going to engage, we're going to put pressure on these companies. And then the language it's been, and I don't think it's going to work, to be honest. And we can
Okay.
more into the major oil companies, Western major oil companies. And a lot of this is being framed in the language of sort of shareholder value creation. And as I said in the piece, climate risk is financial risk. And it's just this incantation where people are waving their hands saying, you need to do scope three reporting and we need a climate transition plan. And you need to sort of become a renewable energy company, even though if you're an oil and gas company, you don't have the skills and capabilities to do it. And kind of the framing is, and we're really doing this because we're concerned about shareholder value creation and the financial risk, to investors. Well, how much is there really? All this pressure on banks about financing fossil fuel projects, 1 year loan, 5 year loan, is there really any kind of financial risk in that? No, I don't think so. You can argue that there's big climate impact, if you're providing financing for an oil and gas company to, go drill new wells or whatever it is. And you can be opposed to that and say there's a lot of climate impact. I mean, I could agree with that. I don't think that, a lot of these initiatives that are sort of the financial sector trying to lead this transition are going to be particularly effective. I think a carbon tax is much more effective, and we can get back to that. And so, as I've watched this over the past couple of years, and I've watched these shareholder proposals come in, I mean, all the anti-ESG shareholder proposals are stupid beyond belief. I mean, it's just like they're so crazy, right? And they get 2%. But not every, kind of so-called pro-ESG shareholder proposal or proposal around climate change is a quality proposal. Some are repetitive, some are prescriptive, some basically take the same proposal and they file it with ExxonMobil and Chevron and Shell and BP. And when I talk to the big asset managers about these proposals, I say, well, how compelling are they to you? And they say, well, most of them aren't. And I don't have a percentage. Maybe the percentage is 25% are good or 30% are good. It's not 80%, it's not 100%. And so I see there's a lot of activity, I think, sort of being done for the most part by well-meaning people, but have adopted this theory of change that somehow, if the financial sector kind of makes enough noise, they can basically make the energy transition happen because they're going to force fossil fuel companies to change their behavior, become renewable energy companies. They kind of duck the question of, okay, there's scope three, how much can an oil and gas company do about a steel company or a cement company in terms of what their sources of energy are? And then there's these practical issues, just a couple. I've mentioned permitting. We want to finance more renewable energy. The problem isn't financing renewable energy. The problem is getting the renewable energy to the grid. There's a famous case, the Northern Pass Project. Massachusetts was going to get low-cost hydropower, out of Canada for 5 cents a kilowatt hour. New Hampshire and Maine, blocked it, even though the developers said they'd put 80% of it underground. So now in the winter, Massachusetts burns coal instead of having hydropower. So it's like, okay, we want the renewable energy, but we want the permitting. So I think that's an issue. And the other big issue for me is let's wave a magic wand and let's say all the Western oil and gas majors are gone. Chevron's gone, ExxonMobil's gone, ConocoPhillips, BP, Shell, Total, all that. What are you left with? You're left with a bunch of national oil companies, with Saudi Aramco being the big dog. Eliminating that supply isn't going to do anything about the demand. Demand's still going to be there. Energy prices are going to go up. And you're going to find Western countries, kind of relying upon, in many cases, unpalatable regimes to be getting your energy, as we saw happen with the Ukraine war in Europe, and when Germany decided that it was going to get out of nuclear energy, which I think was a mistake. So I'm kind of rambling, but you kind of get the point.
So, you're not saying transition plans are bad. You're suggesting that
What I'm saying about transition plans, I think it's really important to distinguish between kind of, and we've talked about this before, ESG integration and impact. I think a company having a climate transition plan saying, from the point of view of shareholder value creation, here's the climate transition plan I have for how I think this company, with its business model and its industry operations, is going to deal with, our, and who knows what the scenarios we look like for climate change. Absolutely makes sense. Okay. Does every company need one? Probably not. Does a law firm need a climate transition plan? I don't think so. Okay. It's a few key industries that are really important, and the board of directors should sign off or sign off if they think the company doesn't need to have one. That's a different thing from the impact that that company is having on the climate. So you could have a transition plan for Exxon, and it could be really quite powerful. And they say, listen, we're going to be the efficient, low-cost producer, and we're still going to be around in 2050. And, our board of directors and the shareholders can have a say, thinks that this will still be a profitable business. They could still be producing a lot of oil and gas that could be having a lot of climate impact. Then the question becomes, how much of it is that ExxonMobil's responsibility? How much of that is public sector? How much of it is their customers? And I think these climate transition plans confound the company sort of explaining how it is it's going to deal with the impact of climate on the company versus the impact that the company is having on the climate.
So
And
it's
I
a
think those
double.
things get confounded a lot. Both are important, but you can't mix them up.
So that's the double materiality perspective that you're
Yes.
talking about there, Bob, right? And I think that leads to, so there, I mean, we're going in different directions here off the top of this conversation.
Well, we
So
always do.
yeah, I know.
I
And
know.
I'd love to come back to this, this double materiality perspective. But I just want to be clear off the top is, it's really this theory of change about the power of the financial sector. Or it's not, I just want to be very clear on what you're suggesting here. It's not that we don't want transition plans, but it's more about this move, your view about the move by the financial sector. About pushing on that particular point as a on activism or engagement, I guess. Is that really what you're trying to get to there, Bob? Is
What I'm saying is, I don't think that the financial sector can be ahead of the real economy.
okay.
That's the key point. Okay. Is the financial sector important in terms of financing the energy transition? No question about it.
Yes.
That was that private conference that I went to that I told you about. It has an absolutely critical role to play. But, you can have examples of companies where they're anticipating some kind of regulation, like an automobile company, and it doesn't happen. So you make some big commitment to electric vehicles, and then you don't have the policies fall into place. And so from a climate impact point of view, that could look good. From a shareholder value creation point of view, it wouldn't look so good. And so I think, what we need to do is say, absolutely important to financial sector, but the financial sector by itself can't solve the problem of systemic risk. And
Okay.
that's what I see it trying to do in some ways.
Okay. All right. So there's a couple of questions that have come in already that some are relevant to right here. So one is I'm wondering about the expectation for financial organizations and companies to support carbon pricing. So you've already mentioned that. And other policies or regulations that would support the business case for climate transition. Should this be where financial institutions put their time and credibility?
I don't know who asked that question. And I know it's anonymous. Let me just say, I love this person. I don't know who this person is. I love this person. It's exactly the right question to ask. I mean, what I've been saying is if we put 50% as much time and energy into arguing about scope three reporting and climate transition plans, and we're focused on how to get to a carbon tax. I mean, is a carbon tax a silver bullet? No. But if you want to reduce a negative externality, you put a price on it. And what's interesting to me is whenever I bring that up, people on the left and right go, well, yeah, but it's never going to happen. Well, that's a cop out. I know a number of conservatives focused on climate change that are absolutely committed to a carbon tax. I wrote a piece on carbon taxes based on talking to a libertarian who's an expert on climate. And so is it complicated and messy in the polarized United States? Sure. But if you had big financial institutions saying, rather than kind of beating up on me and having central banks trying to pretend like they're dealing with climate risk and sort of putting this in the language of financial risk, if you had the financial institutions going to the regulators saying, if you really want us to be allocating capital in a way that it makes sense, what would be really helpful to us is, if there was a price on carbon, And then we can make our decisions on that. You put a price on carbon. There's something I learned about recently, a professor at Oxford named Miles Allen, who's working on something called carbon take-back obligations, which I'm learning about. So there's different mechanisms for doing it. And some, in the case of carbon take-back obligations, are tied to carbon capture and storage and putting it in the ground geologically because the trees eventually die in 100 years from now. And again, I think the role of technologies is important. So I think if you had financial institutions exercising their voice more for we want a carbon tax, as opposed to financial institutions making these net zero commitments, whatever that means, okay? I mean, it's like, what does that mean? If you're a billion-dollar asset manager and asset owner, sure, you can get to a net zero portfolio. Everybody knows this game. You just don't hold any gas stocks, blah, 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 blah. If you've got, 500 billion or a trillion like a BlackRock, what is a net zero plan look like for 2050? I mean, I have no idea. I have no idea. So yeah, I'm all about putting a price on carbon.
Well, that's really interesting. It's not that conversation is a big one in Canada right now, as the opponent to the incumbent government says that they're going to cut the carbon tax and eliminate it, because we actually have carbon taxes in the Canadian ecosystem right now. So interesting conversation there.
And if you look in the US, right? So ExxonMobil has said it supports a carbon tax. And everybody likes to hate ExxonMobil, and I can understand why. I mean, to some extent they sort of, bring it on themselves, but it's more nuanced than that, I think. The American Petroleum Institute does. And people go, well, Bob, they just support it because they know it's never going to happen. Again, I think that's a cop-out. You go and you say, I'm so delighted. I'm very happy to hear ExxonMobil, American Petroleum Institute, that support a carbon tax. All the financial institutions that the questionnaire was referring to, they go to them and say, we're delighted, boys and girls, that you support a carbon tax. And we'd really like to work with you hand in hand to make it happen, implement it in a way that's not a regressive tax, because there's issues that you have to deal with there in terms of income and stuff. I mean, I can imagine that happening. I'm just kind of throwing in the towel. I mean, I think what people are doing, arguing about Scope 3 reporting, double materiality, climate transition plans, net zero plans, they're tools that are usable, but it's like, okay, everything looks like a nail when you got a hammer. So maybe there's other tools, and it's like engaging in the public sector that's difficult and complicated and messy and never fun. But just because you can use these tools don't make them effective. I mean, let me ask you, Milo, you live in this world. Let's make this both ways. I'll ask you some questions. How much difference do you think all these shareholder proposals around, climate issues, how much do you think they've contributed to the energy transition?
Personally, I think that they've advanced the conversations. And I think this has been over, I would say, over the last 3 to 4 years. It's put the topic on the agenda. It's, I think, in Canada, in particular, in the high emission sectors, I think the proposals have definitely put it on the boardroom agenda. And I can say, with high confidence, there are lots of organizations that have now taken that. And they have thoroughly studied what the implications are, and they know what some of those choices are. Capital is the concern. It's how big some of these checks are going to need to be to support their transition. And that's what scares them, is coming to the marketplace and sharing some of those amounts with the investor community. So there's, do we move, do we not move? But that work is, so Bob, I think it has really helped. Is it sort of a stable conversation today? I think, climate is the only topic, like, it continues to be at the top of the list of conversations by investors in this country. But it's, I think there's an a growing expectation that organizations are on that path and that they're able to communicate how they're going to do so
But
to their financial stakeholders.
look at how you answered the question. It's very interesting how you answered the question. You said it's moved the conversation along. It's created higher levels of awareness and understanding. I get that. But then there's been this, oh my God moment when companies sort of look at what the capital commitments are going to be for them to kind of meet these transition plans that the investors expect. Then you're left with kind of a dilemma, right? Then it's either is the public sector, which is kind of happening with the IRA in the United States, is the public sector going to step in and provide some of that capital? Or are the investors who are banging on these companies about needing transition plans? It's easy for you to ask the company to come up with a plan. Then they come out and they say, well, you know what? It's going to cost us this gazillion Canadian dollars over 10 years. And the cash flows are going to be uncertain, and we can't promise you that you're going to get the dividends, and our stock price might go down. We're doing what you want from a long-term point of view. We can transition our business model. We can reduce our climate impact. If you want to kind of say there's a financial risk to this over a very long term, we're going to come to terms with that. But then is the investment community going to kind of step up and basically be consistent with what it's asking for from the companies to allow them to make those investments that are going to not necessarily look all that pretty over a 3 or 5 or 7 year period of time, right?
That's
That's
the
the question.
question.
That's the
That's
question.
the that
I
is
don't
the
have the answer,
question.
but that's the question.
I don't have the answer either, which is what I've been telling numerous boards as I get asked those questions. I have another question here though, Bob. So given given the polarization in the US, and one of the problems is it is that we have way too many entities, third parties and others. Is there a way for the companies to take the forefront and show investors that risk return numbers actually make sense? Again, this is why we were attracted to SASB, given that 75% was quantitative. What needs to happen for this to change and actually have agreement between the left and the trigger?
Between the witch and the witch?
Between the left and the trigger.
Well, I don't get what's the analogy between the left and the trigger,
I'm
the
not
left
sure
and the right.
either. It's
Just Canadian speakers.
I
Yeah, it must be
don't know.
Canadian. Hey, let's go inside and talk about it. So this is another great question. So it's another thank you very much, whoever said this. A little preview. I've got an HBR article coming out on the September October issue called Moving Beyond ESG that lit the newsstands in August. And it's like, okay, here's these culture wars, and the left is saying companies aren't doing enough, and the right is saying you're pursuing some woke liberal agenda. And the companies are kind of saying, oh my gosh, what do I do? Whatever I say, somebody's going to be mad at me, so I'm just going to be quiet. I think companies need to, kind of man up, and say, this is our purpose. This is the problem. Using Colin Mayer's definition, my colleague at Oxford, these are the ways that we are solving problems of people and planet in a profitable way. These are the externalities that we're conscious of. Here's how we're dealing with them. Here's what we can do. Here's what we can't do. Be consistent in your sustainability reporting, and having the standards are good for that. And then engage with your shareholders and other stakeholders. So companies need to shape the narrative. And so if they want to be able to get people to accept their basically model of risk and return, then they can't be shy about it. They need to sort of put it out there. And as I said, guaranteed, the extremes are going to scream about it. The left is going to say you're just making money, while the planet burns. And the right is going to say, well, you could probably be in a lot more money if you weren't doing all this ESG bullshit stuff. But it's the company's responsibility to state the business case for what they're doing. And I think that companies have been, I don't think it's litigation even as much in the United States. I just think, I think it's a question of will,
Okay.
courage, and I think the support of the board of directors. And I think, there's issues around governance where, for the most part, at least in this country, boards are kind of, it's a compliance exercise with all the things you have to go through. And when you have a combined chairman and CEO, as is commonly the case in the United States, I think having a really effective independent board that's overseeing strategy and capital allocation, I think that's hard to do.
Okay. And by the way, it was meant to be left and right. Seems like
Yeah, left
autocorrect
handed.
got in the way.
Okay.
Now, I will move on to this culture wars question, but someone does, there is an anonymous attendee asking, so why should financial institutions engage the public sector to impose carbon tax credits?
I mean, look, I think it's a good question. If they think that it will enable them to make better capital allocation decisions for whatever kind of capital that they're allocating so that they can provide the return to their beneficiaries, then I think there's a pretty solid case for that.
So that's the okay. So let's we've talked about polarization already here, but Bob, you referred to a term called the culture wars,
Yes.
which I actually heard this on CBC Radio that this is an old philosophy actually. Can you talk to us? What does the culture wars mean? What do we mean by this, and where is it bringing us at this point?
Well, it's, kind of bringing us a lot of entertainment. It's taking up a lot of time that could be spent on other things. I was talking to someone this morning who's dealing with a lot of this red state legislation. Let's take a step back again. So, I've been doing this sustainability ESG thing probably longer than anybody because I'm very old, as you know. And this is kind of what it looks like to my wife. It was like, okay, in the beginning, there was ESG and Bob was doing it. And nobody really knew what it was, didn't care. And then they kind of knew what it was a little bit, and it was like philanthropy, and they didn't like it because they thought it was just like, giving money to communities or something. And then some research started getting done. I did some, George Seraphim did some, others say, well, if you kind of focus on the material issues, it's actually good for financial performance. And then people got a little above head of their skis in the asset management industry and companies, and they started claiming all of these benefits for ESG that really didn't have any basis in fact. And then the culture wars came, and now people don't like or understand the left hates ESG because it's only about making money. The right hates it because it's not about making money. So I've become irrelevant again. So in a cycle of 20 years, I've gone from irrelevance to irrelevance, but I have my title flip. When you look at how it happened in the United States, I mean, ESG from when SASB was started, and I've written articles with my Republican friends, which you've seen, it's material risk factors that matter to value creation. SASB is a good guide. You mentioned SASB, it's five or six things on average per industry. Don't confound that with impact. You could be doing a good job on ESG and still producing negative externalities that make the world a worse place to live in. Then, for whatever reasons, and I always hearken back to Mike Pence a couple years ago when he wrote this letter to the Wall Street Journal, and he was talking about environmental, social, and governance as this, pernicious progressive strategy to accomplish things that it couldn't at the ballot box, and asset managers and asset owners were, making political decisions and forcing them on companies, and he starts complaining about the engine number one campaign against ExxonMobil that he said put three environmentalists on the board who are undermining the company from within. Oh my God, three environmentalists undermining this wonderful company from within. Who are these people? It was three people who had experience in the oil and gas industry, which the board had never had. It had like, all star board members, it's diverse, white people, black people, men, women, all these different industries. Nobody knew anything about the oil and gas industry, so they were over allocating capital. One of them I've gotten to know quite well is named Greg Goff. I've done an interview with Greg Goff, which you can find. Who is Greg Goff? Greg Goff was born in Utah, so he likes the outdoors, so maybe that makes him an environmentalist. He had a career ConocoPhillips. He was the CEO of an oil and gas company. He's a Republican. He lives in Texas. He gives a lot of money to the Republican Party. So Mike Pence is like throwing him under the bus as this environmentalist. The disconnect between the rhetoric on the right and the reality of what's going on is astonishing to me. You see that in these red state anti-ESG shareholder proposals. Most of them don't go through. Okay. I mean, it's just like political theater that they're doing to, raise money, get votes, and whatever. You've got Jim Jordan, pursuing this antitrust thing with Ceres and CalPERS and stuff. I mean, it's just nuts. Okay. So, for whatever reason, the MAGA part of the Republican Party decided to make ESG, part of their battle with the liberals. I mean, some of the stuff is nuts. I mean, you see these things, the State Financial Officers Foundation, the Red State Attorney General, some of these House hearings. If you went to these red states, I'm convinced of this, and you go up to Joe and Mary in the local diner and you say, "I hate ESG." They go, "What's ESG?" They go, "It's a thing that liberals like, the people that want to take your guns away and abort babies in the 8 month and stuff." And they go, "Oh shit, man, if that's what ESG is and if the liberals like it, I hate it too." That's the level of sophistication, right? That's going on. That's the level of sophistication in these red states. This legislation gets put up, and you have the state pension fund, and you've got the banking association, and you've got the company association, for the most part, all push back on it because the economic consequences, they've shown this in a study in Texas, is like, because they sort of boycotted all these banks, it's going to cost Texas taxpayers $500 million over the life of a bond. I think that this is going to sort of dwindle out over the next 2, 3, 5 years. Will there still be big debates about climate change? For sure. Will there be big debates about DE&I? And there's even more complicated issues going on with that. But ESG has become just sort of a carrier term, sort of pursue these political wars. And you've got a conversation where it doesn't have any common meaning anymore. I think ESG is material risk factors. People that hate ESG, on the left think it's only about value creation and it's not, kind of systemic risk, so they hate it. The people on the right have decided to call it some woke liberal agenda, and they're saying that these asset managers are trying to force this. No, these asset managers have a fiduciary duty to their clients have to the beneficiaries. And so here's a sign of why I think that this is going to run out of steam at some point. There's a group in the United States called Centerline. Have you heard of Centerline?
Nope.
Oh, well, I sent you an article on Centerline, so it shows you.
I didn't read
Thanks a lot for that,
it.
Mike. Good luck finding it. I'm not going to send it to you again. So what's Centerline? Centerline is this collection of nine center-right organizations, and I'll send it again, who has an initiative to stop anti-ESG legislation in red states. So, the short interpretation is you've got the normal Republicans, the Republicans that they used to be, realize that this is just stupid political theater that's actually detrimental to the citizens in the red states. And so they've got an initiative. It's not a liberal initiative. It's a center-right initiative to address this crazy anti-ESG legislation in red states. And that's why it's a culture war. It's not even a policy war.
Okay.
People are just calling it what they want to call it and then getting wound up. But then what happens? I mean, this is interesting. This is why I think you need to create this conversation in the center, which I'm doing with my friend Tim Doyle, I told you about, is on the left, they all scream and wind each other up, and they're in an echo chamber. On the right, you've got the same thing. And then each one kind of winds the other up even more. And look what the right did, look what the left did. But then what you find, and this is part of the polarization in America, is unless you completely toe the party line with the party that you're considered to be a part of, just one little deviation from the catechism. And it's like, well, I guess you're not a true believer anymore. And I don't want to have anything to do with you. So I tell my liberal friends, well, I'm talking to Republicans. And they go, "Bob, it's nice you're doing it. The subtext is, I'm glad you are and I'm not." And I go, "No, it's actually fun. It's kind of interesting. And I've learned a lot, and I agree with them on some things. What do you agree with them on?" "Well, wait a second. Just because they're Republicans doesn't mean they're stupid, and have bad ideas. Like, I agree with a lot of stuff they're saying about permitting and carbon capture and storage." How you get beyond that ideology, around issues like, let's just say, on climate change, I think is a major challenge. You've got in America this emerging so-called eco-right. I know many of the organizations and think tanks. There's a group that's sort of trying to kind of develop it. And I think if you could, I'm not an expert on climate change. I think if you could get experts on climate change from the left and from the right and say this is a collective problem. And the fact of the matter is, the only way you're going to solve this problem, particularly when you get to the public sphere, is in a bipartisan way. Otherwise,
Agreed.
nothing's going to get done, or the left will do one thing when it's in power, and the right will unravel it when it's in power, like you're seeing in Australia. And that's not helpful.
So everything gets stalled is what
Everything
happens,
gets
and
stalled.
everything
And in the
goes.
meantime, the planet keeps warming up.
So there's another question here, Bob, and it's related more to the stewardship. So given some of the conversation you've had, and it's about Exxon. For those who've not seen the headline news, ExxonMobil sued two of its shareholders, aiming to block a shareholder proposal that demanded the company to set targets for reducing Scope 3 greenhouse gas emissions. This lawsuit marked the first time Exxon has sought court intervention to prevent a shareholder proposal from being voted at its annual meeting. Do you think an action like this will make shareholders sit back and think twice before pushing for these types of proposals? I think this is, back to the original question.
Shareholders is a broad term,
Okay.
and I think it'll make a few think twice. Is it going to make the ones that are filing thoughtful, well thought out shareholder proposals to keep from doing so? No, I don't think so. I think the bigger issue on this is, what kind of decision you get out of the Fifth Circuit Court, right? And that's kind of above my pay grade, and we haven't seen it. So, a bad outcome on that would be a court ruling that in some way clips the wings of what the SEC can do to facilitate shareholder proposals. Do I think that that was a quality shareholder proposal of Arjuna Capital and follow this? No, I don't think it was. Okay, we want you to kind of, limit your Scope 3 emissions. Well, how much can you do about that? Same proposal they filed two or three times. They bought the stock last minute. These aren't real shareholders, okay? Give me a break. These engine number one, it was CalSTRS, it was engine number one. Those were real shareholders. And they had a really serious proposal, business analysis. Here's why you screwed up, your stock price, blah, 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 capital allocation. These things, as I said, they are values-based. I was at a conference in London, that Mark Van Maal guy, whatever his name is, from Follow This. Look, he's an NGO. He's passionate, he's well-meaning, but he's trying to use this tool of shareholder proposals, to force these things happen on companies. So then ExxonMobil, which isn't the warmest and friendliest company in the world, right? So they say, well, we're tired of this. And so, was it an overreaction? Sure, I think it was an overreaction, and it could double back in various ways that aren't good for anybody. But there's been this, kind of spate of these things coming in. And the number of companies that I know and the number of asset managers that I know that sort of, well, kind of is a bad look they've done it, but I'm kind of glad they did, because the shareholder proposal process at the SEC is broken, because once they said you can file shareholder proposals that have broad social impact, and Tim and I wrote about this, I think that's a bridge too far. A securities regulator's job is for the capital markets. It's not to be opining on things that have broad social impact that go outside of the remit of regulating the capital markets. And so I think this whole thing is this mishmash of a shareholder proposal that wasn't very good, after a string of these things that haven't been very good, where it's the same thing filed every year, as I said, and it's not very customized to the companies, and they're too prescriptive. And so there's a lot of unhappiness with how this is working in the system in the United States. And
Okay.
then, ExxonMobil reacts in the way it does. And because it's ExxonMobil, I guess it's not a big surprise. I don't see any big winner coming out of this, but I'm not as concerned as some people are that this is somehow going to put a chilling effect on quality shareholder proposals and engaging with companies. The investor has to be willing to engage with companies, and the company has to be willing to engage. And historically, ExxonMobil hasn't. That's one of the reasons that engine number one was successful, because all these investors are so pissed off, that the way they dealt with them. And so it's going to take two to tango, but I think this particular thing is this going to put a chill on quality shareholder proposals and engagement with the companies? I don't think so.
Okay, I've got a couple of other questions, kind of both related to this, Bob. One is about the tangible impact of the term culture wars. Could these culture wars impact the rollout of the RIA in the US? And then the other is dealing with the SEC. Scope 3, the SEC, what do you think is going to happen at the SEC related to climate disclosures?
So, you know who Yogi Berra is, right? Even though you're Canadian, you know
I
Yogi Berra.
do.
You said predictions are very difficult, especially about the future. So, kind of what happens with the SEC? I don't know. Do SEC first, and we'll do the IRA. It's interesting what happened with the SEC proposal, and it shows you how politicized things have become in the United States. You know, the NRDC and the Sierra Club sued because they didn't have Scope 3. Chamber of Commerce and, you know, red state attorney generals sued because they issued the rule in the first place. And there's this whole issue going on in the United States around the so-called major questions doctrine, and to what extent do agencies have basically the authority to interpret the remit unless it's been specific in legislation, and probably doesn't worth going down that rat hole too much. I have no idea how it's going to sort out. I think in the end, it's going to prove to be a tempest in a teapot, because what you see, and maybe we'll get into this in a bit, you've got the International Sustainability Standards Board, you know, and they're making great progress. It'll never be mandated in the United States, but I can easily see voluntary adoption. You've got the CSRD, which I think is probably excessive in some ways, but, you know, look, it's a law, you know, and 50,000 companies in Europe are going to have to adhere to it. And most of the major US multinationals, and most of where the carbon is coming from, if we're concerned about carbon, you know, they're going to have to report according to that. So will investors end up getting the information that they need? And I'm, as I said, I'm dubious about what you really do with Scope 3, but, you know, people can have different views on this. I think there I'm less concerned about the SEC than I am about how you get to a global baseline, you know, across all the different reporting standards, because you've got ISSB and you've got the CSRD with FRAGs, SRB for ESRS, and then you've got GRI. So, like, how do you sort all that out, right? But you've got a baseline for the single financial materiality, and it's the same definition from both the ISSB and an FRAG. And then you've got kind of GRI for impact materiality and the CSRD for impact materiality. So I think some work needs to be sorted out there. On the IRA, that's a really interesting question, because it's hard to know. I mean, Biden undid things just because Trump did them, you know. And Trump, if he gets reelected, God forbid, he'll do undo things simply because Biden did them. Some of the IRA stuff might be at risk, you know, from talking to people. How much, I don't know. 80% of the money is going to red states. So then it's going to be a question of these red states, to what extent are they going to put their economic interest of their citizens ahead of fealty, you know, to this cult figure that somehow did this hostile takeover of the Republican Party. We'll see. This conference I was at, I mentioned this private conference, a lot of discussion about the IRA. And it has been, you know, positive in a lot of ways. There's ways it could have been more bipartisan. Could it be slowed down? Maybe. But I'm, to be honest, there's bigger problems having Trump as president than the IRA. I mean, there are much bigger problems, let's be frank. I mean, do I think we're going to become a fascist state? I don't think that. Do I think the institutions are fairly strong? But do I think he'll basically run 4 years of retribution and punitive and do stupid things like pull out of NATO and turn Ukraine over to Russia and open up the door for Xi Jinping to invade Taiwan? I think, you know, the geopolitical context of what he could do is devastating, you know, and then there'll be impacts on climate change, but we'll feel these other things before we'll feel climate change. And the ironic thing is he'll do things like put tariffs on products, and that's going to smack a lot of the people in the red states. But because these people are like living in this cult, it's like, you know, Jim Jones Kool-Aid or something, you know, they won't blame him for it. They'll say, you know, the Democrats did something. I mean, it's insane.
So I think it leads to one of the questions that I have, and one of our attendees has had off the top as well. You know, the question here was about European elections, but you know, I think there's a lot of elections happening. You know, they're in Europe, in the UK, in the US. And I know it's hard to make predictions, but where, you know, where do we end up with all of these potential changes in government? What's your thought? I mean,
Matthew,
geopolitically, yeah.
and I'm not a political scientist, you know. I mean, what's disturbing in some ways, I mean, the number of kind of democracies are decreasing as you basically have people becoming dictators, you know, whether it looks like it's through an electoral process or not, I think is troubling. I've been trying the European elections over the weekend, so it's hard to kind of keep up on it all. I listened to something on BBC this morning and it said, well, look, it wasn't as much as they thought, and it's not like completely the right has taken over. The center right is still kind of, where the center of gravity is. But I do think that there's a message in this. And one of the common threads that you see, and I think we need to have a frank conversation about this, is with immigration. Because that's what's driving a lot. It's what's driving it in the United States, and it's what's driving it in Europe. And it's very problematic. And I think in the case of the United States, I think Biden opened up the borders just because, Trump closed them down, and now I think it's a mess here. And then the climate change thing is problematic because unless we get this under control, and this is a conversation I had with a very conservative person who runs a think tank, his concern is that, one of the consequences, one of the shorter term consequences of climate change, as he put it, in these countries that are going to be hit the most and on the coast in the United States at the most, the rich people will get on a plane and go someplace else. And the other people die or they immigrate someplace. And then so like, where do they go? And so you can have, if immigration is a problem now, as climate change hits these various communities in these developing countries that are going to be bearing the brunt of it more, then this whole immigration problem becomes, even more fraught. And I don't see sensible conversation about that. It's like, let everybody in and keep everybody out. Man, it's just neither one of those works.
Some tough conversations that are going to be happening in the forthcoming years as we deal with this. Bob, today's maybe before we kind of close off here, today's the last day for Canadians to give their commentary about the IFRS's S1 and S2. So we have the Canadian Sustainability Standards Board, and our understanding is that what's been proposed but here in Canada is globally the most aligned with IFRS, the S1 and S2. One of the questions that, with the, so there's two questions. Just around the scope three, about, I don't know what your sense is of this implementation. You suggested that it seems to be going super well. Do you think we're going to succeed, particularly with the scope three? But the second question I have as well, though, for you is, you've written about integrated reporting, and the effort here is to have the financial and the the climate related details reported at the same time. What's your view on all of this movement with the IFRS and these standards?
I mean, it's tricky. I mean, I think it's going well. I wouldn't say very well. I think it's too soon to tell on very well. I'm
Okay.
optimistic that it basically become a global baseline and something gets worked out between, FRAG and the CSRD and the ESRS and all those acronyms and the ISSB on financial materiality. I think that'll be done. I think scope three, for the most part, even if it's not going to be mandated in certain jurisdictions, I think companies will be reporting on it. I think at the same time, I think people expect too much from reporting. It's like the CSRD's theory of change. If we just get companies to report on it and every negative externality we can think of, all will be well. And that's not true. And so I'm still, as I've said, skeptical about how information useful to investors scope three numbers are from companies, given how
Okay.
much, I mean, I can get the upstream part, on the scope three. The downstream part, I think, is much harder. And so I don't have the same emotional energy around the scope three thing that some people do. I'm pretty optimistic. 5 years from now, will you have more or less a global baseline? I think you will, and it'll always be imperfect. I mean, they're changing accounting standards all the time, whether it's just, FASB or the ISB. And they go back and forth in terms of how they're going to do goodwill. And then you've got sort of recognition of equivalent frameworks between US GAAP and IFRS. And they're sort of the same and they're not exactly the same. So, it's kind of an ongoing food fight in the standard setting world. And that's true with financial reporting. So there's no reason it should be different from sustainability reporting.
Okay, and timing? Oh, is it feasible to get the financial and the sustainability details reported at the same time?
Absolutely, because one of the advantages of having standards is that you know what kind of internal control and measurement systems you need to have. You know what data you need to collect, and you know you're going to put it through a much more rigorous process because it's going to have assurance on it for the most part. Some cases mandated, some cases not. And that's been the lag, right? Because you've got these big ERP systems from SAP and Oracle that have been scooping up the financial data and doing it for years. And so they know how to close the books and get it together. The sustainability data has been strung around every different part of the country and function and geography and spreadsheets and stuff. And so what you see, I wrote about this in an article on CSOs, what you see is much closer integration between the sustainability function and the finance function. Because the finance function is where there's the skills and capabilities for knowing what kind of internal control and measurement systems you need and what sort of software. So I think as that begins to happen, being able to kind of close that time gap, which has been the struggle for integrated reporting before, I think that'll be solved. I think the bigger problem from integrated reporting is, and it goes back to companies need to be more forthcoming about their narrative and how they see the risk and return is that they're generating. They have to make a clear connection between the sustainability information and the financial performance. They wave their hands and say, you know, sustainability is good and we believe in it. And so please give us more credit in our stock price without nearly the degree of rigor that they do when they make an acquisition and they have to explain that or going into a new product or into a different market. So until there's kind of more rigor, analytical rigor for a company saying, these are the material sustainability issues that we think are important. And here's how we think they affect financial performance as a cost of capital, or revenues, or customer loyalty, or gross margins, or whatever it is. You know, companies need to explain that more.
Make it about strategy is ultimately what I'm hearing you
And
say,
tie to
right?
capital allocation.
And capital
There's another
allocation.
study that I did with some folks where you've got all this, you know, kind of nice language around sustainability. Then you look at how much is the capital being allocated, and is the senior management team paying attention? No, there's a big gap.
There is. Well, unfortunately, Bob, I have many more questions, but we didn't get to most of those. But
Okay.
unfortunately, our time is up, and I'm hoping that in another 10 years, you will not be irrelevant. That we'll be continuing these conversations. So, first and foremost, I'd like to extend a really heartfelt thank you, Bob, for being a friend and a neighbor. To all of us here in Canada for sharing these valuable thoughts. It means, as you know, very close neighbors, and it's hard to have these unique perspectives. So, also, I would say, for us, part of the reason we wanted to do this, we like to challenge ourselves, and we like to help the market challenge their thinking. So, thank you for sharing some of your perspectives in that conversation today. I also want to thank our attendees. Thanks for joining us today. And for those who did share your questions, thanks for actively participating. We really wanted to make this as dynamic and informative for you as possible. So, with that, please stay tuned for future webinars and events. And otherwise, have a great day, everyone.
Thanks, Mala. Always great
Thank
talking
you,
to you.
Bob.
Take care.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Bye
Bye-bye.
bye.